Okay, men, women, modesty, and culture. This is our third time taking a look at this issue. Tonight we're going to look specifically at what is culture. We looked at modesty, and we looked at the differences between men and women, the distinctions. So we want to look at culture and talk about what culture is and the purpose of culture. And there really, once we start getting into that, there are a lot of areas we could go. And I'll probably allude to a couple of things, but I don't want to get bogged down in that. But I do want to point out to you that what we're going to talk about not only is bearing on the subject at hand, that is men and women, the distinction between the sexes and modesty and so on, but it has much broader connotations for the activity of the church, for the application of Christianity, and so on. So I don't want to get too far off of our topic at hand, but I'm just going to try to point out some things along the way that might be things to keep in mind. All right, modesty and its relation to culture is something else we need to talk about. That what it is when a culture exhibiting modesty, how that's going to look, what that will reflect. I want to briefly address how the distinction between the sexes should be reflected in culture, and then sort of how the culture enforces the distinction between sexes at recognition. Briefly, then we'll talk about toward the end what culture has to do with conversation. And by conversation, what we're talking about are social manners, social behavior, that entire social deportment amongst people. And finally, again, briefly, we're going to talk about how culture dictates custom. So we're going to talk about the difference between culture and custom a little bit. What I probably should say beforehand is there are some aspects of culture regarding differences between nationalities, between various ethnic groups or whatever, that are peculiar to them. So when we talk about culture, we're recognizing that there is some room for variation, what we might call cultural variations. And that would be reflected in customs. But we have to be very, very careful that we don't, in the course of looking at the form, to the extent that culture and custom has respect to a formal conformity to ultimate reality, as we're going to see, that those formal differences are not to be confused, which can change, they're mutable, should not be confused with what is substantial. So there's a constant substantial underlying reality that should be reflected, as we're going to see, in every culture. And so, for example, any culture that fails to reflect in a very fundamental way the distinction of sexes, which is one of the things we're concern to discuss. Is de facto missing the point of where we're going, okay, with this, and I'll explain why as we proceed, but it has to do with the relationship between culture and worship. So let's begin, because there's a lot to talk about here. Question one. What is the origin of or source of culture? So the words cultus and culture bear a resemblance because they are etymologically derived from a single root. The Latin root is calo, which means to till, inhabit, or nurture. And thus the word cultus, by figurative extension, refers to worship. And significantly for our discussion, it also figuratively refers to dress, clothe, or adorn. Culture, then, is the outward manifestation or manner of the beliefs of a particular group of people. Look at Ezekiel 23:15.
Ezekiel 23:15, girded with girdles upon their loins, exceeding in dyed attire upon their heads, all of them princes to look to, after the manner of the Babylonians of Chaldea, the land of their nativity.
Okay, after the manner of the Babylonians. Right, then we can multiply examples. But that manner is, as we're going to see, really a word very much in line with custom. And custom and culture, as we're going to see, are very much connected, right? They're very much expressive one of the other. So culture is the outward manifestation of the beliefs of a particular group of people, and this is transmitted through a series of traditions or customs, sometimes enforced through societal or ecclesiastical discipline. Look at Acts 26:3.
Acts 26:3. Especially because I know thee to be expert in all customs and questions which are among the Jews, wherefore I beseech thee to hear me patiently.
And other times they're enforced through laws. If we look at Acts 16:21.
Acts 16:21. And teach customs which are not lawful for us to receive, neither to observe, being Romans.
Right. So we could probably add or expound upon that and say, look, societal, when we talk about this, we're talking about familial, we're talking about civil. Customs. There are customs that show up in all of these societal relations. And they are the result of culture. And culture itself is the result of cultus, how a people worship or don't.
Right. Which explains our culture today.
It actually, there are things, we'll have reason to refer to that as we go on, but the crisis and the, you've heard talk about the culture wars and so on. And this is not, this idea of culture wars and so on is nothing new. In the 19th century in Germany, it was called Kulturkampf, and when Hitler wrote his book, he said, it's Mein Kampf, it's my struggle. The culture struggle, Kulturkampf, is my struggle. That's what he was talking about. So he cast his bid in 1923, I believe it was, when he wrote that, based upon the idea of this culture struggle that's going on in German society. And it's something that had been recognized as going on for quite some time before there was a Hitler. This is already something which was under discussion. And the reason is, this is actually something that is always under discussion. It's always been a point of contention. Because it flows from worship. And anytime you have a society with people of different fundamental beliefs, metaphysically, and with that in mind, different forms of worship, it's going to become a flashpoint. Because different cultist, each cultist is going to form a different culture to some extent. We'll talk about that as we go. And as these words have a single root, then, so too the departments of life which they designate stand in an organic combination. Look at Psalm 135, 15 to 18.
Psalm 135, 15 to 18. The idols of the heathen are silver and gold, the work of men's hands. They have mouths, but they speak not. Eyes have they, but they see not. They have ears, but they hear not. Neither is there any breath in their mouths. They that make them are like unto them, so is everyone that trusteth in them.
Yeah, so the idea here is, as is the cultist or the worship, so is the culture. Right? You become like what you worship. As an individual and as societies, whether familial, ecclesiastical, civil. Psalm 115, verses 1 to 8.
Psalm 115, 1 to 8. Not unto us, O Lord, not unto us, but unto thy name give glory, for thy mercy and for thy truth's sake. Wherefore should the heathen say, where is now their God? But our God is in the heavens. He hath done whatsoever he hath pleased. Their idols are silver and gold, the work of men's hands. They have mouths, but they speak not. Eyes have they, but they see not. They have ears, but they hear not. Noses have they, but they smell not. They have hands, but they handle not. Feet have they, but they walk not. Neither speak they through their throat. They that make them are like unto them, so is everyone that trusteth in them.
So again, the psalmist reiterates this point that those that make and worship idols become like them. And conversely, we should understand that those who worship the true God, they're going to become like him. And this is, without getting into the whole question of worship, right, and how we're to worship God aright, but this is exactly why worship, how we worship, is such an important thing. Okay, if we are wrong about this, it's going to affect our culture. The Jews, and this is something that in amusing ourselves to death, Neil Postman pointed out that the Jews, because of the prohibition on images, they had and do have a word-oriented society. And this has made them concentrate more on study rather than looking at pictures. All right? Idols are teachers of lies. Looking at words makes you think, not just evoke emotion. And that, in turn, has a much broader effect on society. Why are there so many Jewish lawyers and doctors? The large part of that, Postman asserts, is because they don't have this image orientation that so many Gentiles do, particularly in their worship. Right? And one of the great objections that Reformed Christianity had to Romanism was this idea that idols or that statues and pictures were books for the laity. Right? That this is how we're going to teach people, through pictures. you become like what you worship, whether you realize that or not. And if you neglect worship, you become, in fact, unable to defend a culture. So as we go through, what I want you to keep in mind is, throughout the Western world, what used to be called Christendom, there are various remnants of Christian culture. But the conservative movement has been unable to defend or protect that precisely because it's lost sight of how to worship God aright. In fact, the Puritanic approach to worship, I would assert, is peculiarly related to the early success of the American Republic. Despite the disconnect between the general populace and the federal government, or the government of the states, governments of the states. Anyhow. The various ethnic divisions forming the nations and kingdoms as cultured nations, Egyptians, Babylonians, Persians, and Romans, exhibit in their culture the devotion found in their cultus, their worship. It's 2 Kings 17, 27 to 33.
2 Kings 17, 27 to 33. Then the king of Assyria commanded, saying, Carry thither one of the priests whom ye brought from thence, and let them go and dwell there, and let him teach them the manner of the God of the land. Then one of the priests whom they had carried away from Samaria came and dwelt in Bethel, and taught them how they should fear the Lord. Howbeit every nation made gods of their own, and put them in the houses of the high places which the Samaritans had made, every nation in their cities wherein they dwelt. And the men of Babylon made Succoth, Benoth, and the men of Cuth made Nergal, and the men of Hamath made Ashima, and the Avites made Nebaz and Tartak, and the Sepharvites burnt their children in fire to Adrammelech and Anammelech, the gods of Sepharvaim. So they feared the Lord and made unto themselves of the lowest of them priests of the high place, which sacrificed for them in the houses of the high places. They feared the Lord and served their own gods after the manner of the nations whom they carried away from thence.
Okay, so broad ethical decisions are made by societies in conformity with what they worship. Like their cultus. What has been the great idol of the West since the decline of the Reformation, one thing has been statecraft. People tend to worship the state. And the state takes on itself all of the trappings of worship. It has its symbols and its singing and its reverencing and all of that. That's culture. It's not good culture. It's not flowing from a Christian cultus. It's flowing from some kind of heathen cultus. But it's still a culture being derived from a cultus. Right? So the Greek culture stood in this undeniable fundamental connection with the religious cultus and became its reflection, as noted throughout several places in the New Testament. For example, look at Acts 17, 16 to 21.
Acts 17, verses 16 through 21. Now while Paul waited for them at Athens, his spirit was stirred in him when he saw the city wholly given to idolatry. Therefore disputed he in the synagogue with the Jews and with the devout persons, and in the market daily with them that met with him. Then certain philosophers of the Epicureans and of the Stoics encountered him, and some said, What will this babbler say? Others some, He seemeth to be a setter forth of strange gods, because he preached unto them Jesus and the resurrection. And they took him and brought him unto Areopagus, saying, May we know what this new doctrine whereof thou speakest is? For thou bringest certain strange things to our ears, we would know therefore what these things mean.
for all the Athenians and strangers which were there spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or to hear some new thing.
Right, so culture derives from cultus, worship. Okay, and everyone does. Everyone has something they worship that they idolize. Every society. You know, there is, Christianity has been in decline in the West, there has been an increase in the worship of money and power. That's your God then. Maybe it's free time, leisure, entertainment. That's your God. And because we have another God, it's a failed God, but the God of democracy, then all of these gods of all the people have to be taken into account and worked into the culture. But you see, it's not as though the West is a blank slate. Western culture was largely the result of Christendom. And that connection was most pronounced and was most consciously pursued by Reformed Christianity after the Reformation in modern times. So culture arises from cultus, and before we get into this this conflict that I've been alluding to, I think we should consider then question two: what is the purpose or task of culture? What is its purpose? Culture, the purpose or task of culture was given to man. It was created in the image of God, and it was given to him as his task from the beginning in the form of a command, which, depending on how we read it, might also be understood to be a promise. Right? If you look at Genesis 1, 27 and 28.
Genesis 1, verses 27 and 28. So God created man in his own image, and the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them, and God blessed them, and God said unto them, be fruitful and multiply, and replenish the earth, and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth.
So what is culture doing? Culture is imposing the dominion of man as the image bearer of God on the creation. Right? Without the man, there was none to till. And the word here in Genesis 2, 5, we're going to look at in a minute, is la of that, of avad, which can mean to perform acts of worship. Or it can also mean to cultivate, which the word cultivate means to impose culture. Right? So to cultivate the ground is, in some sense, to impose culture. Genesis 2, 5.
Genesis 2, verse 5. And every plant of the field before it was in the earth, and every herb of the field before it grew. For the Lord God had not caused it to rain upon the earth, and there was not a man to till the ground.
There's no man to till the ground. In other words, that the image bearer of God is not yet impressing that dominion on the creation. But when God creates man, he creates him to do just that. And that task is continued to be given to the man after the fall. Genesis 3, verse 23.
Therefore the Lord God sent him forth from the Garden of Eden to till the ground from whence he was taken.
But here's the problem. After the fall, the wisdom or knowledge, remember when we talked about that a couple of weeks ago, the wisdom or knowledge that's necessary for this task was not to be found amongst any but the people of God. Acts 17:22-25.
Acts 17:22-25. Then Paul stood in the midst of Mars Hill and said, "Ye men of Athens, I perceive that in all things ye are too superstitious. For as I passed by and beheld your devotions, I found an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God, whom therefore ye ignorantly worship. Him declare I unto you. God that made the world and all things therein, seeing that he is Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands, neither is worshipped with men's hands, as though he needed anything, seeing he giveth to all life and breath and all things."
Okay, so this possession of the knowledge that Paul's talking about the Gentiles don't have, which is really necessary for that cultural task, they don't have it. That continues to be the privilege of the Jews until the time of Jesus. Look at John 4:22-23.
John 4:22-23. "You worship, you know not what. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. But the hour cometh, and now is, when the true worshippers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For the Father seeketh such to worship him."
So, Jesus is saying, up until this time, salvation is of the Jews. In other words, they're the ones who have the true knowledge. They're the ones who have what's necessary to perform this culture task. This is not something which belongs to all the Gentiles. They don't have that. And hence, Paul notes that prior to the coming of Christ, the Jews who had that knowledge, they sought for a sign, a demonstration of proof or an indication of where they were along the lines. They're looking for Messiah to come. Whereas the Gentiles, the Greeks, the Gentiles, sought after that knowledge or wisdom that they need for this culture task. Jews already had it. Look at 1 Corinthians 1:22.
1 Corinthians 1:22, "For the Jews require a sign, and the Greeks seek after wisdom."
Yeah, the Greeks were seeking after wisdom. They need that in order to have a consistent culture. They know that that's a necessary thing for them to be a cultured people. By the way, we're going to see that by the time of Christ, the Greeks had attained probably as much as anyone could through the light of nature. So much so that Paul in Romans 1:14 could say that he could refer to barbarians or Greeks, or Greeks or barbarians, I think is the way he has it. And then he says the wise or the unwise. So he's acknowledging a certain level of wisdom in the Greeks that non-Greek speakers, barbarians means non-Greek speakers, foreigners, people who are outside of the Hellenization of the empire. They don't have that wisdom. And he's saying that they don't have that culture and they don't have that level of civilization because they're all tied together. So, the Greeks are seeking after this. The Jews already have it. Thus, then, when commenting on the Great Commission set forth by Jesus Christ in Mark 16:15,
"And he said unto them, Go ye into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature."
Yeah, the fact is the Apostle Paul, who is the great apostle to the Gentiles, gives a profound exposition of this command, setting up a culture ideal which cannot be discovered outside of Christianity. Look at Romans 8:19-21.
Romans 8:19-21. "For the earnest expectation of the creature waiteth for the manifestation of the sons of God. For the creature was made subject to vanity, not willingly, but by reason of him who had subjected the same in hope. Because the creature itself also shall be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God."
So, everything that actually reflects culture, as we're going to see, arises from a proper alignment between a nation and the light of nature. Okay, that natural revelation of morality that is written in their hearts. We're going to come back to that, but you have to keep that in mind. Right? Not everything that all of the heathen nations have done have been entirely devoid of evidences of recourse to this natural revelation. But they've all fallen far short of what Christianity can do. And we're going to talk about why that's important in a couple of minutes. But you should already be thinking along these lines that this is important. More important precisely because of the special revelation and the debilitating aspects of sin. Therefore, we would say that any aspect of culture which reflects a Christian cultus, which has given rise to Western or what we would call Occidental culture, is to be cherished. Look at Psalm 102:14.
Psalm 102:14. For thy servants take pleasure in her stones and favor the dust thereof.
Those who are servants of God take pleasure in her stones. So he's really talking here about the fact that so precious is the temple of God, even when it's been destroyed, that the things that pertain to that temple are appreciable by the people of God. And that's what we're saying. Anything that is an accurate reflection of natural morality is worthy of being cherished wherever we find it. So we don't just simply dismiss, but we do have to evaluate, particularly when we're dealing with cultures that are heathen, or dealing with cultures like our own, which at one time were heavily heavily influenced by Christianity. And now we have all of these pagan things coming in and throwing things into confusion. Fact is this, strictly speaking, there's no fostering of morality without the fostering of religion. For where there is religion without morality, the religion is not real. Look at
James 2:26. James 2:26. For as the body without the spirit is dead, so faith without works is dead also.
And where there's morality without religion, there's either a concealed faith, such as the altar to the unknown God that Paul addresses in Acts 17:23.
Acts 17:23. For as I passed by and beheld your devotions, I found an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God, whom therefore ye ignorantly worship, him declare I unto you.
All right, so it's either concealed faith, or it is merely a self-imposed subjective morality. Look at
Proverbs 3:5. Proverbs 3:5. Trust in the Lord with all thine heart, and lean not unto thine own understanding.
Now, here's the problem. The gods of the heathen are actually nothing. So if you're worshiping something other than the true God, you don't have a transcendent principle that is, in fact, intruding or interrupting or imposing itself from without upon the creation. What you actually have is an expression of the sinful human will. So, with that in mind, those who think that those aspects of culture which reflect Christian cultus ought to be replaced by a culture arising from purely human concerns, they would do well to consider that here is an ethic arising from the sinful flesh walking in darkness, and it ends in doom. Look at Galatians 6:8.
Galatians 6, verse 8. For he that soweth to his flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption, but he that soweth to the Spirit shall of the Spirit reap life everlasting.
So what is it when culture arises from the flesh? That is, when culture arises from the society rather than culture being something that is in a sense being imposed from without. When it arises from the sinful wills of those people who compose the society rather than the will of the divine lawgiver from without. You know, what do you have? We have a sowing to the flesh, and you're going to reap corruption. It's not going to end well. In fact, we can say that even those moral elements of culture found amongst heathen nations can be traced back to the light of nature, reflecting these higher concerns as the creature before the Creator. Look at Romans 2:14-15.
Romans 2:14-15. When the Gentiles, which have not the law, do by nature the things contained in the law, these having not the law are a law unto themselves, which show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and their thoughts the meanwhile accusing or else excusing one another.
So the fact is, and we've talked about this in different contexts, everyone comes into this world with the work of the law written in their hearts since the fall. We call it the work of the law precisely because we know, as we're going to read in just a moment, that they're holding the truth in unrighteousness. They're not holding it in proper relation and to God in particular, but also to man. And therefore, it's not going to give proper expression to the divine will, because it's going to arise from a cultus that is extremely deprived when it comes to necessary elements to fill out this picture. Right, so by nature, for example, by natural revelation, you can know that there is a God. But you're not going to know who that God is. You're going to be able to know, and I've said this in other contexts, that he needs, but nature's not going to tell you how to worship him. Which is why we don't want to bring elements of nature into the worship of God, something he has prescribed. We don't want that to be matters in sacris. Natural revelation can inform, as we'll see, in matters circusacra, concerning sacred things, but not in sacred things. We don't look to nature to derive doctrine or practice in the church, or worship or government, for that matter. Any kind of doctrine relating to these things, or practice. So, even these moral elements amount to holding the truth, as I said, in unrighteousness. And they fail to accomplish the true task of culture, which is to make creation subject to the divine image. Romans 1:18-32.
Romans 1:18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. And verse 32. Who knowing the judgment of God, that they which commit such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but have pleasure in them that do them.
Right, so, culture, to the extent that it's really culture, what we could call genuine culture, It's a genuinely cultured aspect. It's really referencing the singular focus on the work of the law among the heathen nations. To the extent that they've focused in on some or other aspects of that, it'll be reflected in that culture. But because they lack special revelation, they're not going to hold it in this truth in righteousness. What that means for us now is we have to hold it in Christ, because He's our righteousness. So the problem is then, as I alluded to, those who would defend the culture of the Christian cultus, people like Christian culture, people like Thomas Jefferson, kind of like Christian culture, but he didn't want to defend Christianity, right? Those kind of people act like the prodigal son. When he reaped all the benefit of his father, reaching a man's estate, he turns his back on his father and his house, takes a portion of his father's goods, and he goes to a strange land where he forgets his origin. Look at Luke 15, 12 to 14.
Luke 15, verses 12 through 14. And the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the portion of goods that falleth to me. And he divided unto them his living. And not many days after, the younger son gathered all together and took his journey into a far country, and there wasted his substance with riotous living. And when he had spent all there, there arose a mighty famine in that land, and he began to be in want.
Right, so what is happening? We've got a conservative movement in the West which likes certain aspects of Christian culture. But they don't want to defend the Christian cultus. It's not going to work for long. You have no bulwark. You're just going to continue to give up point after point after point. Because everything, it turns out, is really relative. It's all relative. So as difficult as the truth may seem, those who renounce heaven cannot genuinely possess the earth. Think about that. You know, most of these people are materialists, they're present-oriented, but the Bible is actually teaching if you renounce heaven, you don't even get to have the earth. Whereas Christ says, seeking first the kingdom brings with it all things. In Matthew 6:33,
but seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you.
The Apostle Paul adds to this that true cultus, godliness, is profitable for this life as well as for the life to come. 1 Timothy 4:8.
For bodily exercise profiteth little, but godliness is profitable unto all things, having promise of the life that now is, and of that which is to come.
Okay, so just as I said, I was going to mention a few things along the way. The fact is this. Part of the great task of Christian missions is to carry with it a re-envisioning of culture. As we're going to see in a few minutes here, those countries which are more cultured, those which have been more attentive and focused and have managed to discern more of those principles of natural morality, which are summarized in the Ten Commandments, those cultures also are the more civilized people. All right? And they're going to have, along with that civilization, they're going to have a lot of the features that we would associate with Christian culture. And by that, what I mean particularly is they're going to exhibit modesty. Right? We've talked about modesty. We're not really going to get into modesty much tonight, but we'll be talking about that over the next few weeks, Lord willing. But they're going to exhibit modesty in regard to their conversation, which again we mean their behavior, which includes the way they speak to both to one another and about things. All right, the way they dress, and just the general order that they observe between men and women. We're going to come back to that. All right, question three. How is modesty related to culture? Well, think about this. Since culture is a result of man's creative activity being imposed upon creation in order to fulfill that dominion mandate given to man from the beginning, look at Isaiah 45:18.
For thus saith the Lord that created the heavens, God himself that formed the earth and made it. He hath established it and created it not in vain. He formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord and there is none else.
Right. God didn't form the earth in vain. So he formed it to be impressed upon, to have impressed upon a culture. Now it must be, is a very central concern of life. And since man is essentially a religious being, culture expresses his cultus, his worship of God. Psalm 8, verses 4 to 9.
Psalm 8, verses 4 through 9. What is man that thou art mindful of him, and the son of man that thou visitest him? For thou hast made him a little lower than the angels, and hast crowned him with glory and honor. Thou madest him to have dominion over the works of thy hands. Thou hast put all things under his feet, all sheep and oxen, yea, and the beasts of the field, the fowl of the air and the fish of the sea, and whatsoever passeth through the paths of the seas. O Lord, our Lord, how excellent is thy name in all the earth.
The psalmist is showing you the connection there between cultus, his worship of God, and culture, his concern for dominion. And they're intimately related. Now, since modesty consists in a deportment of moral quality that frames the heart and the mind to walk consistent with the commandments of the Lord, this, too, must be found to be rooted in the cultus. Because the cultus, the worship, is our response to the presence of God. In Micah 6:8.
Micah 6, verse 8. He hath showed thee, O man, what is good, and what doth the man require of thee, but to do justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with thy God.
And the reason is the cultus, the worship, is that central action of the exercise of seeking to both God and man. In other words, by orienting ourselves properly toward God, we're not only oriented properly toward God, but toward man. Because by being oriented toward God, we're being properly oriented toward God, we are then properly oriented toward the creation. And man is the crown of that creation. Matthew 4:10.
Matthew 4:10. Then saith Jesus unto him, get thee hence, Satan, for it is written, thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve.
Yeah, thou shalt worship the Lord. Look at the order Jesus says. Worship the Lord. Dulia. And serve him. Latria. Right? Dulia is that divine worship that we offer to God. Latria, contrary to what Rome says, latria is serving God basically by exercising this this culture task. We serve God, and this is where the Protestant Reformation in the doctrine of vocation restores something that had been lost throughout the Middle Ages, you know, for a long time in the West, and during the Middle Ages. And this is one of the things that I would suggest made it the Dark Ages and contributed to this feudalistic system that existed, was the notion that the only true vocation was in the church. The only way you really serve God is in the church. The Protestant Reformation came along and said that's not true. Right? You serve God in your calling. Because our calling is not simply to the church, but we have this broad culture task. which involves everything. We have to take dominion over the earth and all of the creation. Right? So modesty, then, is the mediating point between the interpretation of reality inherent in occultists, and this is really what we need to understand and why how we worship is so important, right? Worship in occultists, how we worship God is, in fact, is our acquiescence to an interpretation of reality. Right? There's only one proper interpretation, and that's what God has determined. That's why we're only to worship the acceptable way, as the Westminster Confession says, acceptable way of worshiping God is limited by himself. It's so limited by himself. He's told us how to worship. And if it's not commanded, it's forbidden. Because we need to have this proper worship. Why? Because this is the point at which we are being attuned to the proper interpretation of reality in our cultists, in our worship. And from there, culture flows, from cultist to culture. But the problem is, because of the fall, man, what is needed for the man to be receptive to the true cultist, so that there is, in fact, faithful culture, is that the man has to be humble before God. There has to be modesty of heart. This modesty idea. So, between the interpretation of the reality inherent in the cultist and the manifestation of that reality in a culture is this principle of modesty in the person. We want to look at Psalm 36:9 compared with Proverbs 14:2-12.
Psalm 36, verse 9. For with thee is the fountain of life, in thy light shall we see light.
Proverbs 14:2-12, verse 2. He that walketh in his uprightness feareth the Lord, but he that is perverse in his ways despiseth him. And verse 14. Verse 12. There is a way which seemeth right unto a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death.
Right. So in God's light we see light. And a proper cultist is, in fact, the true cultist, the true way of worshiping God, and the reason why it has to be limited by his word, is because that's where we begin to see light. That's where we perceive reality as it really is, not as we would determine it to be. From that, or in comparison to that, we can see that if you don't, there are ways that seem good to us. These are self-chosen. These arise from the will of the flesh, and we're told that these are the ways of death. Which is why the Bible indicates that contrary to this modesty that is needed is the pride of sinful flesh, which exalts itself against the divine determinations of what constitutes morality and its cultural implications. Look at Daniel 4:37.
Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all whose works are truth and his ways judgment, and those that walk in pride he is able to abase.
Those who walk in pride, he's able to abase. But what happened to Nebuchadnezzar? He thought he knew. He thought he could, in fact, raise up a culture contrary to that which was revealed to him in the light of nature. And God cast him down into the dust. And he confesses that was pride. He was walking in pride, and just like God cast down Nebuchadnezzar for walking in pride, he can cast down anyone for walking in pride. In fact, he will. It's not just he can, but he will. It's more of a promise. It's because it's the nature of reality. God is a just judge. The those ways, the ends of those ways, are death. So, we have between cultus and culture either this midpoint in the persons that are participating in the culture and manifesting it in the implications in culture, participating in the cultus, the worship, and manifesting in the culture. We have either modesty, which disposes them to receive what God is really about over here with cultus, with the worship, so that it's being more clearly reflected in the culture, or you have pride of flesh, right? The sinful pride of man, which is in fact rejecting whatever doesn't like over here in cultus, in the worship. It's rejecting what it finds by natural light and law. Nevertheless, we can say that unbelievers are religious beings which remain inherently cultural creatures, but they're striving after the wind. Look at Ecclesiastes 1:2.
Ecclesiastes 1, verse 2. Vanity of vanities, saith the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity.
Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. You know, they pursue culture, but the culture isn't really rooted in God's determination of reality. Right? That's why they don't like the regulative principle of worship. They want to worship God as they see fit. They've made determinations. Only genuine modesty can restore that which has been destroyed. Right, by the fall in particular, but by sin. Get Isaiah 61:4.
Isaiah 61:4. And they shall build the old wastes, and they shall raise up the former desolations, and they shall repair the waste cities, the desolations of many generations.
All right, question 4. What does a culture exhibiting modesty reflect then? A culture that exhibits modesty actually reflects a proper subjection of that society in its outward manifestations to the true divine cultus. It's really what it's reflecting. Get
Colossians 1:17. Colossians 1:17, and he is before all things, and by him all things consist.
By him all things consist. Right? What is it about, you know, false worship that fails here? It's not going to reflect the concerns of the God in whom all things consist. In other words, the culture's never going to reflect reality. Just as an aside, what we talked about a couple weeks ago, right? This gender dysphoria. I don't know whether I'm a boy or a girl. You know, where do you get that? Well, you get that when you have the sinful wills of men rejecting the true cultus, trying to establish, they have some other idol they put there, and it's now determining their culture. But culture is, genuine culture exhibits modesty. And that modesty is the proper subjection to show us that cultus, that divine cultus. And beside that, it transmits through a series of customs which are designed to conserve this manifestation faithfully. So how does culture, how is it conveyed from, let's say, from generation to generation, or from those who are within a particular culture to those who are outside of it? Through customs. Look at Acts 28:17.
Acts 28:17. And it came to pass that after 3 days Paul called the chief of the Jews together. When they were come together, he said unto them, Men and brethren, though I have committed nothing against the people or customs of your fathers, yet was I delivered prisoner from Jerusalem into the hands of the Romans.
And so Paul is saying, look, I haven't done anything contrary to these customs, but you're treating me this way. Why? He's saying it's not, you know, it's not the customs. Right? He's saying that as they are departing from the truth, they're departing from true custom, really. And it's apparent in the way they're treating him. Right? So to the extent that the culture of a given society exhibits the reality revealed within the cultists, it will necessarily exhibit modesty. Acts 17:28.
For in him we live and move and have our being, as certain also of your own poets have said, for we are also his offspring.
Yeah, it's going to. Why is it going to? Because when you're in touch with that genuine cultist, and you are in fact faced with it, and you respond with that kind of modesty, the culture that comes out of that itself reflects that modesty which apprehends the truth in the cultists. That reality strikes the hearts of men with humility, which is an internal modesty. Look at Proverbs 22:4.
Proverbs 22:4. By humility and the fear of the Lord are riches and honor and life.
Yeah, by humility, which is the fear of the Lord. You know, the Hebrew is a little more terse there. It just says humility, the fear of the Lord. Now, the problem with unbelievers is they don't have the fear of the Lord. The problem with societies that don't reflect modesty is they are approaching the cultists without the fear of the Lord. In other words, they're holding the truth in unrighteousness. And that's disastrous. But the fact is this, culture penetrates everywhere. It's carried by the light of nature, independently of the gospel, somewhat like the atmosphere which penetrates even the most closed rooms. Look at Job 12:10.
Job 12:10. In whose hand is the soul of every living thing and the breath of all mankind?
Nothing is outside of this. Because all men are going to be exhibiting culture, right? They're going to be manifesting what they really worship. Thus, even those heathen nations, which are or have been most cultured, for example, India, China, Japan, nations like that, are those having more defined and organized expressions of their attachments to a cultus. And that gives those shimmerings of natural revelation deeper penetration into the respective societies. John 1:9.
John 1:9. That was the true light which lighteth every man that cometh into the world.
And Christ is the true light that lighteth every man that cometh into the world. Right? To the extent that they have light, they have it from him, though they don't know they're getting it from him. Is that law is his law. That light that comes from that law is his light. They're using it, but they're not giving him credit for it. Because they're pagans. Nonetheless, when as a society, when they focus their attention toward discerning that natural revelation, at each point where they hit upon it, it's that the, having the whole society focused like that, when you have, you know, the whole society Hindu or Shinto, it's causing them in those areas where they do grasp the truth, though they're going to hold it in unrighteousness, nonetheless, it's going to be reflected in the culture of their society in a much more concentrated form. They're going to have a form of modesty, right? It's going to reflect as because they're in submission to the points where they agree. They're determining good and evil, but their agreement in those points that they accept will, in fact, show forth in modesty. And it's for this reason that traditionally or customarily, These societies have exhibited greater modesty, as witnessed in their clothing, their manners, and regard to maintain order, including maintaining proper distinctions between the sexes. And they've done that more than more primitive societies, which are often lacking in these respects. You get Romans 1, 19 to 22, and Jude 10.
Romans 1, verses 19 through 22. Because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has showed it unto them. For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because that, when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools.
Jude 10. But these speak evil of those things which they know not. But what they know naturally, as brute beasts, in those things they corrupt themselves.
Yeah, what they do naturally as brute beasts, in those things they corrupt themselves. Right? That's what the more primitive societies are corrupted in their knowledge, the knowledge they have of this natural revelation. They've corrupted themselves more. Right? How do we tell? Well, their manners are more primitive or uncivilized. Their clothing is more like they don't wear clothing. Right? The order that they maintain between men and women is much less defined than it is amongst those societies which are more cultured and therefore more civilized. That's what the light of nature can do, depending on if you pay attention or not. However, the culture that should and will exhibit this modesty, really in its best and most complete sense, is that which arises from the Christian cultus, because this receives the light of the gospel, bringing much needed correction to heathen departures from natural revelation, together with the power to live according to the law. Romans 8, 3 and 4.
Romans 8, verses 3 and 4. For what the law could not do in that it was weak through the flesh, God sending his own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh, and for sin, condemned sin in the flesh, that the righteousness of the law might be fulfilled in us, who walk not after the flesh, but after the Spirit.
So the real problem is, you know, for the unbelieving world, is that revelation, that natural revelation, doesn't have the power, an inherent power, to make you understand it. Right? It's the Spirit of God is not accompanying it like it is the revelation of the gospel, or the revelation of grace, which is why different societies are suppressing that truth in unrighteousness, to different degrees. Right? And to the extent that they are, we need to understand they become less civilized, which means that they become less ordered, which means that their communities are, in a sense, more chaotic, and they become more animalistic. Right? They're like brute beasts corrupting that what they have naturally. They become like brute beasts. That's what becoming primitive is. They weren't created that way, but they become that way. This evolutionary idea that all these so-called primitive peoples around the world, you know, that they've only evolved this far, is foolishness. No, these primitive peoples around the world are the people who have most departed from that natural light, most rejected that natural light, and they're reaping the consequences. You know, they run around naked. And they kill one another over a stone. You know? They have very little organization. The distinction between men and women, there isn't, you know, women are more degraded. The more primitive the society is, the more degraded women will be in those societies. The more cultured the society, the more that distinction will be respected between men and women. But because there isn't the effect of the gospel, as we will see, the gospel brings a necessary correction to the curse that's been put on this distinction that makes the plight of women in heathen cultures historically, it's just simply a matter of fact, women have been greatly abased in even the most cultured of heathen nations in comparison to Christianity, the Christian West. Right, there are reasons for that. But let's move on to the next question here. Question 5. How should the distinction of the sexes be reflected in culture? Well, there are several ways in which the distinction of the sexes should be reflected in the culture, which is itself rooted, as I've said, in the cultus, the worship. And these must begin with upholding natural morality in all of its implications. Look at James 1, 23 and 24.
James 1, 23 and 24. For if any be a hearer of the word and not a doer, he is like unto a man beholding his natural face in a glass, for he beholdeth himself and goeth his way, and straightway forgetteth what manner of man he was.
Yeah, think about what James says. He's like a man who beholdeth his what? His natural face in the mirror, and goes away and forgets. Right? That's what happens if you're culture isn't reflecting the true cultus, the divine cultus, the genuine cultus. But even with only the natural revelation, to the extent that they reject that natural revelation, they suppress elements of that, it's like someone looking in the mirror and walking away and forgetting that part of what they just saw. So the distinction of sexes, it has to begin with upholding natural morality and all of its implications. Otherwise, you're going to have problems, which is why the heathen have problems, even in the most cultivated or cultured or civilized societies that they've had. There are still problems. Women are still treated in certain ways that are contrary, really, to the gospel. Look at it has to begin with a fundamental recognition of these sexes as distinct. Look at Matthew 19:4.
Matthew 19:4, and he answered and said unto them, have ye not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female?
And it has to keep in focus here that these distinctions are the beginning of all order in society, whether we're talking about familial order, ecclesiastical order, or civil order. 1 Corinthians 11:8-9.
1 Corinthians 11:8-9. For the man is not of the woman, but the woman of the man. Neither was the man created for the woman, but the woman for the man.
Okay, so this distinction between men and women, male and female, has implications for vocations. Right? This is from nature. Right, natural revelation, enforced by special revelation. Women are trained and encouraged in the domestic circle. Titus 2:3-5.
Titus 2:3-5. The aged women likewise, that they be in behavior as becometh holiness, not false accusers, not given to much wine, teachers of good things. That they may teach the young women to be sober, to love their husbands, to love their children, to be discreet, chaste, keepers at home, good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God be not blasphemed.
Whereas men, on the other hand, are to be formed for the public business of life, including war. Ruth 4:1-2 and Jeremiah 48:14.
Ruth 4:1-2. Then went Boaz up to the gate and sat him down there, and behold, the kinsman of whom Boaz spake came by, unto whom he said, ho, such a one, turn aside, sit down here. And he turned aside and sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, sit ye down here. And they sat down.
Jeremiah 48:14. How say ye, we are men and strong men for the war, or we are mighty and strong men for the war?
Okay, and the reason for pointing out war is, if we remember, you know, war is a necessary thing because of the fall. Because there is now idolatry. And because the duty of men is outward looking, whereas women are inward looking, looking into that domestic, gazing into the domestic, that outward look is most pointed and pronounced in war, when you're basically being called upon forcibly to put down the wrong worldview, the wrong culture, the wrong implications of culture from a false cultus. Okay? Additionally, then, this distinction has implications for clothing, which you look at
Deuteronomy 22, verse 5, the woman shall not wear that which pertaineth unto a man, neither shall a man put on a woman's garment, for all that do so are abomination unto the Lord thy God.
And we're going to be talking about that in more detail, as well as the manners or conversation. Look at Romans 13, 13 and 14.
Romans 13, verses 13 and 14. Let us walk honestly as in the day, not in rioting and drunkenness, not in chambering and wantonness, not in strife and envying, but put ye on the Lord Jesus Christ, and make not provision for the flesh to fulfill the lust thereof.
Okay, so there are a couple words here that I want to point out. Chambering, the word is koitais, which refers to sexual excesses. Right? It's referring to the marital bed. Koite is the word for marital bed. And this is referring to any kind of behavior that is lewd, lascivious, and excessive between the sexes. That, you know, leads to fornication, basically. Wantonness. Asselgeis, which means the lack of self-constraint, violating what's socially acceptable. Right, so wantonness, again, is put together with chambering. Why? Well, because here you've got a lack of modesty. You know, this is the kind of thing that, and we have to ask ourselves, socially acceptable to who? Right? Socially acceptable to primitive heathen people? No. They don't define culture for Christians, let alone for just simply civilly moral people, right? Let alone Christians. No, our canon for what's socially acceptable has to be that natural revelation as seen through the corrective lens of special revelation and the restorative properties of the gospel. So when you violate that between the sexes, again, this is tied to chambering. You know, over-familiarity, you know, flirting, those kinds of things, these are problems in a society. They're not only immodest, they're problems because they are, in fact, violations of that modesty. So what they have to do is we have to maintain a proper relationship between the sexes in all conversation in society, all our manners, right? There shouldn't be an over-familiarity. There shouldn't be a lot of social intercourse. And the distinction has implications as well in, as I point out, the verbal communications between men and women. Look at 1 Peter 3:6.
1 Peter 3:6. Even as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters ye are, as long as ye do well, and are not afraid with any amazement.
Okay, so we're going to look at, we will be looking at this idea of modesty and conversation, including speech, because it's not, this example is Sarah calling Abram Lord, but the fact is that this is a broad concern, because it has to do with, again, that communication between men and women. And what is, in fact, violating this canon of modesty. All right, let's move on to question six. How does culture enforce this distinction of sexes? Culture enforces a distinction of the sexes by establishing societal expectations associated with each. Look at Numbers 1, 3, and 1 Timothy 5, 13, and 14.
Numbers 1, verse 3. From 20 years old and upward, all that are able to go forth to war in Israel, thou and Aaron shalt number them by their armies.
1 Timothy 5, 13 and 14. And with all they learn to be idle, wandering about from house to house, not only idle, but tattlers also, and busybodies, speaking things which they ought not. I will therefore that the younger women marry, bear children, guide the house, give none occasion to the adversary to speak reproachfully.
Okay, so there are these certain societal expectations. Again, in the Bible, the highest societal expectation, in a sense, for men is on this issue of war. Because it's really, if you understand what's going on, it is that the point of the spear, where the Christian cultus is pushing back against all of the corruptions in culture that have arisen through false worship, right? It is the ultimate dominion mandate when you finally have to take someone out and kill them, because that's the only way to get to the culture that's being demanded by true cultists and true divine worship. On the other hand, the realm of the women is focused inward toward the domestic circle. And that's why women are more nurturing, generally speaking. And men are more aggressive, generally speaking. I know there are exceptions to that. Of course, a lot of the exceptions we see today are actually the result of perversions that have been introduced into our culture. Right, this distinction then has been maintained after the entrance of sin, but because of the curse placed upon the man and the woman, it's more onerous to be born by them. So the distinction between male and female, men and women, was there before the fall. But as a result of sin, it's become much more onerous to be born by them. Look at Genesis 3, 16 to 19.
Genesis 3, 16 through 19. Unto the woman he said, I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children, and thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee. And unto Adam he said, because thou hast hearkened unto the voice of thy wife, and hast eaten of the tree of which I commanded thee, saying, thou shalt not eat of it, cursed is the ground for thy sake. In sorrow shalt thou eat of it all the days of thy life. Thorns also and thistles shall it bring forth to thee, and thou shalt eat the herb of the field. In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread, till thou return unto the ground, for out of it wast thou taken. For dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return.
Okay, so what is the woman told, first of all? She's told that her desire would be to her husband, but he would rule over her. And the general thought here is that he's going to domineer over her. All right? That he's going to be overbearing toward her. That's going to make her domestic task more difficult. For the man, everything that he touches is going to be becoming corrupt, right, because of the curse. So he's going to meet with all kinds of frustration in what he's doing. So for both of them, there is this additional burden placed on them because of the curse. Therefore, then, when the lineaments of nature are ignored in the culture of a nation, it's required. It's a mark, an emblem of corporate sin and mark of divine judgment. Look at Isaiah 3, 12 and 13.
Isaiah 3, verses 12 and 13. As for my people, children are their oppressors, and women rule over them. O my people, they which lead thee, cause thee to err, and destroy the ways of thy path. The Lord standeth up to plead, and standeth to judge the people.
What's interesting about that verse, beside the fact that it's pointing out the unnaturalness of women bearing the rule in societies, is the fact that we're told that, you know, children will be their oppressors. Now, very often the Bible is accused of being anti-woman. But the same people that tend to do that also accuse the Bible very often of being overly infatuated with children, particularly having them, and overly concerned about fertility. Well, you know, the Bible here is no more anti-woman in saying this than it's anti-child. I mean, by their own admission, it's not anti-child. So why they would go to a verse like this, as I've seen some people do, and claim that it's anti-woman is beyond me. Anyhow, there is in this that whole issue of role reversal, disorder. Role reversal is disorder. And that is, in of itself, it is immodest. We'll be touching on some of these things in more detail. And some of these things really are not going to be the big focus of what we're going to be talking about. So I'm just trying to mention them along the way, but they do have a lot of bearing in other areas and other topics. Now, on the other hand, the introduction of the gospel not only enforces the real demands of nature, it also ameliorates the blasting effects of sin, which make maintaining this distinction so difficult since the fall. Look at Ephesians, for example, Ephesians 5, 22 and 28.
Ephesians 5, 22. Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord. Verse 28. So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself.
Okay, so the gospel has not only come to uphold and clarify that natural revelation, but it's come to restore that which is necessary for us to bear a proper relation to that natural revelation. And it comes with the power that is not present in the law by itself. So question seven, then. What does culture have to do with conversation? Well, like when culture, particularly to the extent it reflects natural law and the reality of creation, when it enforces that distinction between the sexes, because it forms a social environment, it finds expression in the conversation or manner of nations. So when it's forming that social environment properly by reflecting that cultus, it's going to become apparent in the conversation or the manner of the nations. Look at 2 Kings 17, 26 and 33.
2 Kings 17, verse 26. Wherefore they spake to the king of Assyria, saying, the nations which thou hast removed and placed in the cities of Samaria know not the manner of the God of the land. Therefore he hath sent lions among them, and behold, they slay them, because they know not the manner of the God of the land. Verse 33. They feared the Lord and served their own gods after the manner of the nations whom they carried away from thence.
Right. This relation is so close in culture and conversation that quite often we speak of culture by referencing the manners of conversation respecting this or that particular societal action. For example, look at Ezekiel 11:12.
Ezekiel 11:12. And ye shall know that I am the Lord, for ye have not walked in my statutes, neither executed my judgments, but have done after the manners of the heathen that are round about you.
Yeah. So when he's talking about the manners, he's talking about certain aspects of their behavior, their societal behavior, that is embedded in their culture. Right? How did it get there? It's contrary. Well, again, it's gotten there through false worship. It's gotten there because they're worshiping idols. So just as culture is observed through the lens of the nation in which it's found, the nation is more or less cultured as it reflects that natural revelation, right? So the conversation or manner exhibits those characters. Look at Judges 18:7.
Judges 18:7. Then the five men departed and came to Laish, and saw the people that were therein, how they dwelt careless, after the manner of the Zidonians, quiet and secure. And there was no magistrate in the land that might put them to shame in anything, and they were far from the Zidonians and had no business with any man.
Right, so culture then, we can speak of culture in terms of nations, right? Culture takes on a national quality. So what we have to discern in culture, in coming weeks we'll be talking about this more, but we have to discern in culture is the substance of that culture, all right, which if it's reflecting the divine worship properly, the substance is going to be the same. The outward form of that may be variable.
Yeah, so during the millennium then, the substance will be the same for all the nations, but the outward form will be different, like...
Yeah, there'll be covenanted uniformity in worship and so on, yes, but...
But the Asians will have their own culture, and, like, you know, like...
Correct.
Indians will have their own
yes,
culture.
Yes, everyone will have
but
their
the
own
substance,
culture.
You know, the foundation of that will be the same across all peoples, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So it's almost like in the things indifferent, they can differ in a way.
Yes. Well, they're going to be... You think of it... I would tend to think of it more like... what's happened is humanity, it's sort of like shooting humanity through a prism, right? There's one humanity, but when it goes through the prism, you see all these different, the spectrum, okay? If you imagine that spectrum being large enough to take in all of the nations, which is... I biblically, historically, I think there are recognized to be 70 of them. 70 nations in total. But anyway. Again, the most cultured of the nations, considering the effects of the entrance of sin, are those nations most wrought upon by the influences of grace. Right, so the most cultured, or another way you could say this, the most civilized. I know people don't like to think of it that way, but really, the more you have exposure to the grace of God, or that you've had exposure, the more civilized. And quite frankly, what that means is that historically, Western European nations who have been Christianized have been more civilized historically than the Jews that rejected Christ. All right? And that's not going to change until the Jews are converted, except that, you know, the Western Christian nations are going backward. But the reality of what happened at certain points in history is unchangeable. And, you know, the fact is Gentiles took it further than Jews that are now unbelievers. Right? But anyway, the nations that have been most wrought upon by the influence of grace, amongst them alone is found acceptable conversation which is applicable to all of its members, whether they're believers or not. Right? So it's only in those nations most informed by grace where you can say the culture and its conversation, the manners it's instilling, are applicable to everyone, believer and unbeliever. And if we're in a culture as believers, a culture of unbelievers, you know, their culture is not going to be sufficient for us as believers. Look at Numbers 15, 13 to 16.
Numbers 15, verses 13 through 16. All that are born of the country shall do these things after this matter, an offering made by fire, of a sweet savor unto the Lord. And if a stranger sojourn with you, or whosoever be among you in your generations, and will offer an offering made by fire, of a sweet savor unto the Lord, as ye do, so he shall do. One ordinance shall be both for you of the congregation, and also for the stranger that sojourneth with you, an ordinance forever in your generations. As ye are, so shall the stranger be before the Lord. One law and one manner shall be for you, and for the stranger that sojourneth with you.
Yeah, one law or one manner. That is one conversation. In a country that is, in fact, in submission to that special revelation of the covenant of grace, you only need one law, one manner. The problem comes in when you've got heathen cultures, because they've rejected and suppressed the truth and unrighteousness in various areas. You know, we can't live by them. We can't be guided by what's acceptable, an acceptable standard in their eyes, right? Their idea of modesty is going to be very different from what the Bible is telling us, and what the light of nature rightly interpreted would tell us, which is what we're going to find in the Bible. The light of nature rightly interpreted. So when I'm talking about culture, you know, we need to be very, very clear. Our concern should be the only culture that really counts, and that's the culture that is conformed to the true divine cultus, the true worship of God, which is the Christian worship. Now, we're not quite there yet, but this is precisely why on these matters of conversation or behavior, clothing, and order, particularly with respect to men and women, the Puritans saw so much more clearly than virtually anyone else, because they were the most concerned to worship God as he commanded. Probably no one since the early church had been that concerned about finding the true worship of God, worshiping as he had commanded. All right, question 8 then. How does culture dictate custom? So let's think about this for just a moment. If we understand culture to form the social environment, then we should understand that customs are those national or local traditions which function as means to articulate this culture for ease of transmission. So look, for example, at Luke 2:42.
And when he was 12 years old, they went up to Jerusalem after the custom of the feast.
After the custom of the feast. What was the custom of the feast? It's all those traditions designed to transmit from generation to generation, and perhaps even from believer to unbeliever, what they're doing there at the temple. That's what customs do. Customs sort of fix that culture in a series of traditions that allow that culture to continue or be transmitted, right, from one place to another. Because these customs are expressions of culture, and culture is grounded in cultus, we should expect that all customs arising from heathen devotions, so far as they depart from natural light, can only transmit the vanity of their origins. And that's what we're told in Jeremiah 10:3.
Jeremiah 10:3, for the customs of the people are vain, for one cutteth a tree out of the forest, the work of the hands of the workmen with the axe.
Right, and that's the account of idolatry going on there. But the customs of the heathen are vain. The people are vain. The heathen customs are vanity. Moreover, the people of God are expressly told not to defile themselves with such things. Look at Leviticus 18:30.
Leviticus 18, verse 30. Therefore shall ye keep mine ordinance, that ye commit not any one of these abominable customs which were committed before you, and that ye defile not yourselves therein. I am the Lord your God.
So we're told not to keep their customs. Right? The things that arise from a wrong apprehension of the divine imperative for the cultural mandate, you know, the things that they've wrongly interpreted in their cultus, we're not to take those. We don't take those. We're not going to participate in them. And if you don't think it's idolatry driving it, again, you will hear people say today very clearly, you know, my God isn't like that. When you start telling them what God wants them to do or not, my God is not. No, your God is not like that, because your God has arisen from your flesh, your sinful flesh. But the God is like that, and the God, the true God, is saying that. Whether you like it or not. You know, modesty is submitting to that. And not saying, I know better. Instead, then, Christians ought to study to see that their customs are scriptural and conform to the dictates of the gospel. Look at Ezra 3:4.
Ezra 3:4. They kept also the Feast of Tabernacles, as it is written, and offered the daily burnt offerings by number according to the custom, as the duty of every day required.
Right. So they're keeping these things according as it is written, that is, according to the scriptures, and conform to the dictates of the gospel. That is, they're doing it in light of the sacrificial system, which is looking forward to the coming of Christ. That's what we ought to do. We ought to see that our customs are scriptural and that they are conformed to the dictates of the gospel. Right? That they take in both that proper interpretation along with the remedy for all of the excesses and the difficulties presented because of the curse, because of man's fall into sin. All right. So with that, we're going to move in the next few weeks to look at we're going to look at modesty in relation to conversation and in relation to clothing in general. That's going to make us I think we're going to have to look at the whole issue of the reason for clothing and what the Bible has to say about nakedness. And, you know, what that is and what the concern is here. And so all of these things have bearing on the issue of modesty. So we're going to begin to move into that. When we look at conversation or manners, we're going to have to look at not simply the general interaction of men and women, because that's really where we're focusing, men and women. But we're also going to look at the question of speech. We need to address that a little bit and what it means to speak modestly about things. So we'll try to begin to address some of these things over the next couple of weeks.